All right, whose name did you come up with regards to this person who has been achieving? He did so in sports, and now he's doing so in politics. Yeah, I'm thinking you're probably saying that could be anybody. It could be Mario Cuomo. It could be, okay, let me give you a clue. He is from New Jersey. Yeah, there you go. Senator Cory Booker, someone who some people are saying may make a 2020 run for the presidency of the United States of America. Well, I'd love for you to hear this conversation that he had with Dev T. Smith about where he is and where he may be headed. Black Enterprise.
We are here with none other than Senator Cory Booker this morning. We're going to be talking a whole lot about everything you guys want to know about social justice. And we're going to talk a little bit about what inspired Mr. Booker to get into politics as well.
First of all, welcome to my office. Thank you for coming here.
So much.
Appreciate it.
You mentioned that as a child, you used to watch the RNC and the DNC and just tune into politics. I want to know, where's the root of that passion come from at such a young age to pay attention to something like that?
Well, you know, James Baldwin said that children are never good at listening to their elders, but they never fail to imitate them. And so I had two parents who were very focused on issues of social justice and felt, really saw American history as this continuing evolution towards a more perfect union, towards a more just nation, but that didn't just happen accidentally. It happened because folks struggled for it and fought for it. And so the political contest wasn't about the gamesmanship of politics to them. It was about the real issues of our time. And when people are trying to cut things or investing in people, whether that be cutting education or even just the kind of safety net that keeps folks from falling and their children falling through the cracks, my parents were very engaged. And so the leadership of the time, whether it's Jesse Jackson's famous speech in the Democratic Convention, or you capture these sort of moments that, for me, were very compelling.
I think that's an interesting thing to say, because I argue with my parents all the time about politics, right? We didn't start having those discussions until later on in life. I didn't find my way into like being engaged or developing some type of base level knowledge of what was going on in the country, right? But you're saying that you and your parents had those discussions and...
Well, don't get me wrong. I mean, I was a kid. I mean, I was playing video games and sports and stuff like that. But when you're sitting at a kitchen table, from the time you can remember, 4 or 5 years old, and you have the adults around, many of them participated in the civil rights movement, telling stories, talking about their pains, talking about their aspirations, you absorb those things. So whether you know it or not, you know, my mom has this saying, she says, behind every successful child is an astonished parent. And but I tell my mom, she shouldn't be so astonished, because that's the model that she set for me and with her lives, my mom and my dad.
What do you feel were some of the habits that you honed in on to perfect your craft, so to speak, when it comes to policy, when it comes to educating yourself on how to do your job best? Obviously, you didn't arrive here overnight. This is a chain of intentional events that got you here, right? Are there any key things that you picked up along the way that you use daily to excel at your job?
Well, first of all, there are skill sets that we all use no matter where you are in life. Entertainment, media, policy and politics, athletics that really serve you well. And so, you know, I was an athlete. I was a high school All-American football player, but sports was really the area that I felt like I learned a lot of my great lessons about hard work, discipline, grit, sacrifice. When I got to Stanford, things went bad for me. I was this highly recruited athlete, but within a few months, I dropped way down on the depth chart. But I still decided, you know what, I'm going to take this adversity as a test. Can I emerge as a great student? Because I felt like I got into Stanford, not because of any academics. And so I felt like I had something to prove. And the classroom where I was intimidated, I decided, you know what, I may not be as naturally gifted, smart as some folks, but I'm going to outwork everybody. And a lot of people who I see who are successful are the ones that are willing to sacrifice stuff so that they can rise in what their chosen field is.
For me and the people that I hang out with, when we watch what's going on in the news and we're paying attention to this current political climate, it's at times tough to stay motivated. It seems hopeless a little bit sometimes.
Right.
What do you say to millennials, to Generation Z, to those of us who are moving into a space where we will be effectively, you know, running the workforce and running the country, so to speak? Are there tangible exercises that you think could be going on at the community level to keep us engaged so that we stay in tune with what's going on and ultimately make sure we turn out to vote and don't lose focus.
Every decision we make is a political act with consequences. And there are a whole lot of people that are really invested in turning you off from politics. And by you being turned off from politics, they are winning as a result of that. Millennials, your generation, forget Republican or Democrat, all millennials that overwhelmingly believe in everything from common sense gun regulation, immigration reform, marriage equality, marijuana legalization, keep the internet open and free, but they don't participate. In many ways, the complicity of people's apathy and lack of engagement is allowing narrow groups of political interests to do the things that are making people politically turned off. Imagine if the civil rights activists, I'm not talking about the 60s civil rights activists, right. I'm talking about people in the 40s and the 50s who were being beat and lynched and killed, if they said, well, this looks hopeless, I'm not gonna get involved. Right. Where would we be today?
Right.
What about the suffragist jets or the abolitionists
yeah.
who would never live to see the freedom that they fought for achieved? You know how hopeless it was to think we could end sweatshops
right.
or end child labor? It was impossible. Yeah. People that organized, they didn't just lose their jobs, their livelihoods, they lost their lives, but they kept fighting.
Yeah.
And so if we who luxuriate in the blessings that were born from the struggles of those who came before,
right.
how dare we insult our history of activism by not being activists ourselves?
I think a lot about investing in correcting the criminal justice system. That's like a big thing for me personally. I have friends who are in the criminal justice system, and it just kind of seems a little backwards at times, right? I don't think anything can be perfect, but people being stuck on probation for like 10 or 15 years just kind of seems outlandish to me, right? And that's just one issue. What do you think are the most detrimental aspects of the criminal justice system as it stands? Like, what are the things that we need to attack first and correct, in your opinion?
So first of all, I think your focus is right. I think it is the biggest cancer on the soul of our country. Is what's happened and since the 1980s alone, we've seen the federal prison population go up like 800%. Overall prison population in America go up 500%. The hypocrisy of it all, that you have people here in Congress who have used drugs, but yet still protect a legal system that is churning people into it. Not everybody. I went to Stanford University. There's no stop and frisks walking home from frat parties at Stanford University. There's nobody raiding dorms there. But African-American communities, low-income communities in general, are so much more targeted by this criminal justice system and feeds upon the most vulnerable. Women, most people don't understand that we have a sexual assault to prison pipeline in this country. In other words, overwhelming majority of the women, about 86% of the women in our federal corrections and state correctional facilities, are survivors of sexual trauma. We actually take girls who are victims of sex trafficking, and we often bring them into the criminal justice system because even though they've been victims and are survivors, we treat them like criminals. Instead of putting them in trauma-informed care facilities, we put them in facilities that compound their trauma. Over 95% of criminal convictions now are done by plea bargaining. And I've had young fellas sit in my office like you who say, this was the deal I was offered. Be trialed as a juvenile or cop to a lower felony charge and leave with a felony charge. Or they would bring me into adult court, stack the mandatory minimums, I would face 20 years. Of course I took the deal to get out, but they don't realize, like you said, having a felony on your record is a lifetime sentence.
Right.
You can't get Pell Grants, you can't get food stamps, you can't get business licenses, you can't get jobs. You have a lifetime sentence. This system is toxic in every way. I wouldn't even pull out one thing. I would just, let's have a conclusion that this criminal justice system is wasting American taxpayer money. No other industrial society incarcerates like we incarcerate, to the tune of hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars. Our roads are crumbling, our bridges are crumbling, all of our infrastructure has gone from the top of the planet Earth to now out of the top 10, except for one area.
Wow. We're gonna hear the rest of that shortly. One thing I wanna point out briefly, did you notice that he said there are people, particularly politicians, who are vested in turning off people from politics so that you won't engage.